From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, open enrollment for the Affordable Care Act starts this week as the Trump White House slashes support funding and consumers are left confused.
They don't know that the open enrollment period has been shortened. They don't really know when it's kicking off because the other thing that was eliminated was advertising for the Affordable Care Act, for the enrollment.
How a strict disciplinary school can change the course of a student's life.
I really see it as being the opportunity to break that school-to-prison pipeline.
Social media outlets wrestling with allowing free speech yet not letting trolls and haters wreak their havoc.
So there's been this long-standing idea in internet communities that if you stamp out a bad behavior, it's just going to spread all over the place.
And John U. Bacon on the Lions' third straight loss.
They're built to be a wild card team, and that's what they're going to be.
Those stories and more on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Twitter, Facebook, and others have struggled to police the hateful speech and outright lies that circulate on their social media platforms while maintaining our cherished values of free speech. Later in the program, we learn what one popular social media platform has done to fight back against the trolls. But first, this Wednesday marks the start of the open enrollment period for the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare. This fifth enrollment season is the first one under President Trump, and it's marked by what critics call his determined efforts to undermine the ACA. Marianne Udall-Phillips from the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation is here to walk us through what to expect. Marianne, President Trump insists the ACA is imploding. Let Obamacare die is an oft-repeated talking point of his. And even as Congress has failed to repeal and replace, many critics believe the president is doing his best to undermine the ACA. So what do you think? Is the health care law in Michigan broken?
Well, you know, we know that the ACA could use some help, and some of the decisions that the administration has just made about not paying these what's called these cost-sharing subsidies has made premiums go up, has made it more expensive for many people, but not all. But it is not broken in Michigan. Michigan continues to have many choices of health plans. In fact, we have 8 health issuers in the state, and every county has a choice of at least 2 health issuers. So we've only lost one plan in Michigan, one health insurer, that's Health Alliance plan, but it continues to be robust. We're in the top 10 states in terms of the number of plans offered, and in every county there will be choices.
So, but there are some new hurdles to overcome and how things are going to be different this year. So let's start with the shorter enrollment period starting November 1st and ending December 15th. Right. Now, prior year's enrollment ran into March, didn't it?
Yes, that's right. And so this is much shorter. And as you said earlier, there are days when the system will be down and there aren't navigators to help. So it's much more complicated for people to get into the system.
So how do you think that this might affect enrollment?
Well, many people think it's going to lower enrollment. There are estimates out there that it'll lower enrollment by 10% or more. People are really concerned about the complexity and, frankly, all of the press and all of the debates about the Affordable Care Act this summer.
And the attempts to repeal and replace.
Right, has left some people with the feeling that it has been repealed and that they're not enforcing the mandate and that there aren't going to be choices of health plans. And so there are people that are very confused, and all of that is likely to depress enrollment.
When we talk about the fact that the White House has slashed funding for navigators to help guide people through enrollment, how critical are those navigators in your view?
You know, the navigators have been enormously helpful to people. The Affordable Care Act, if you buy your coverage as an individual on the health insurance exchange, it's enormously complex. You do have a lot of choices, which is good, but it makes it hard to figure out what you're really eligible for, what your tax credits are, what the plan differences are, and those navigators have been crucial in helping people really sort through. They're not just about getting information out to say you should enroll. They're also really about helping counsel people on how to enroll.
Now, with the slashed funding, does that mean no navigators or fewer navigators?
It means fewer.
So people are going to have to be patient.
Yes. And in Michigan, the funding was slashed quite a lot for those navigators, more than in many other states. So many fewer navigators. Now, we do know that hospitals are going to step up, that health plans are stepping up, that there are a lot of voluntary efforts going on. And In Washtenaw County, for example, we're training students at the University of Michigan School of Public Health to go out on a voluntary basis to help people enroll. So there are a lot of communities that are trying to help, but it won't be quite the same.
Let's talk about this sticker shock. The average price for an individual plan in Michigan has jumped nearly 27%. Why is this?
Well, because these cost-sharing subsidies were not paid, because the president said that they will not pay them, and Congress has not overruled that.
And what are those exactly? Help us understand. This is complicated stuff for a lot of us. What are these subsidies?
Yeah, so if someone is below 250% of poverty, that's about, for an individual, $30,000 a year that they earn. If they're below that and they're eligible for health insurance coverage, the law requires that the copays and deductibles they pay be lower than they would be otherwise because their income is so low. Mm-hmm. And it requires the health plans to lower those copays and deductibles. The law intended the federal government to pay for that reduction in the copays and the deductibles. And there was a debate about whether or not those funds were actually appropriated correctly under the Obama administration. So there's been a lawsuit debating whether those funds were ever appropriated by Congress. And the health plans are required to lower those copays and deductibles regardless of whether the federal government pays the share or not.
So they have to make it up somehow?
They have to make it up somehow. And so what they did in Michigan at the direction of the Michigan Insurance Commissioner was to raise the premiums in the silver plans that they offer. And they raise them different rates, so an average between 8 and 20 and up to 38%. We had one health plan raise their rates 38% to make up for those reductions. And that cost then gets spread over everybody else who buys their coverage in the insurance exchange.
Now, which of the plans on the exchange might see the biggest hike? And the reason I'm asking this is, as I've read the flood of stories that came after the president announced that those federal payments were going to be canceled, is that the silver plans were particularly going to be hit hard.
The insurance companies put those increases entirely into those second lower cost silver plans, which is how the subsidies are calculated. It's very complicated. But all those are the plans that are hit the highest. And so we have this funny experience right now where there are some communities where a gold plan that has lower copays and deductibles may actually be cheaper for somebody than a silver plan, because those silver plans are the ones that went way up.
So some people might wind up being able to get a more generous plan for less money.
Yes, they may be able to get a more generous plan. And that's particularly people who are in this income range between 250% and 400% of poverty. So people who earn between $32,000 and $48,000 a year might find a plan that's cheaper in that gold range. And it's going to be more complicated. And that's another point about the navigators, because they don't have people to guide them through this. You would think that those, you know, bronze plans or silver plans are going to be the cheapest for them. But in some cases, it'll actually be the gold plan.
Now, what are the ACA enrollees who make too much to qualify for any of the tax credits to help offset the cost? Are they going to bear the brunt of this?
They are. We have about 61,000 people in Michigan in 2017 who got coverage on the exchange and who were not eligible for tax credits. 81% of people in Michigan who got coverage on the exchange were eligible for tax credits, but those 61,000 people are the ones who are going to be hurt the most by this lack of payment for the cost-sharing.
How badly?
Subsidies.
On
average, that premium increase goes up 27%. They'll have to bear that full increase, but it does vary by community, by age. So people really have to look at the health plans. They still should shop in the marketplace. Again, there are a lot of choices of health plans. Mm-hmm. Some of them went up quite a bit more than that 27%, but some went up less. So they really need to shop around.
The Washington Post, in one of its stories on this, quoted a Georgetown law professor, and I'll read you his quote. "For those who thought it was a story when several years ago there were startup difficulties with the website, that's nothing compared to what we're going to see. How can there not be chaos?" That's what this professor says. What do you think?
I think there is more chaos. Well, there's no question there's more chaos already. I mean, people are confused about, they don't know that the open enrollment period has been shortened. They don't really know when it's kicking off, because the other thing that was eliminated was advertising for the Affordable Care Act, for the enrollment. That was slashed. And frankly, right now, the administration is running negative ads. They're really bashing this law. And so that leads to chaos by itself. You know, it's something that the health plans are trying to overcome. It's in the interest of the health plans to get a lot of people to enroll.
Especially healthy people and younger people.
And one of the challenges for younger people is that they tend to wait till the last minute to enroll. And so, you know, that's really going to be a push.
Do you think, Marianne, that we might see more people this year say, you know what, to heck with it, I'm going to pay the penalty of tax time?
Oh, I do. I absolutely do. I think that we're going to have people who are going to, first of all, they're going to see that 27% increase. And if they don't get tax credits, they're definitely going to be saying, you know, maybe I shouldn't be getting coverage. The people who will get the coverage, and this is the issue, are people who are sick or have family members who are sick or who know that they're going to need a major procedure. And that's, again, that drives the cost up for everybody. Because if you only have sick people covered, then you're basically paying the cost of that medical care. You're not really doing what insurance is designed to do, which is share the risk and pool the cost.
Now, there are people who completely support President Trump's goal of ending Obamacare. They voted for him because they want the ACA gone. They believe it's been a disaster. What do you say to people who had their health care choices ruined or made, you know, prohibitively expensive under the ACA, and they can't wait to see it gone?
Well, I wish people would look at the bipartisan effort that's come out of the Senate. So Senators Murray and Alexander have worked on a bipartisan effort that would help lower the cost. I think it could bring the cost down by 20% because it would pay for those cost-sharing reductions. It would allow flexibility in states. It would allow people to buy bronze plans who are older than 30. Now they're limited to people who are 30 or younger. So that is the way we should be changing and reforming the Affordable Care Act. It should be through a bipartisan effort. There are enough votes in the Senate to get that bill passed, but it won't be put up because President Trump has said he's not in support of it. And so I think we need to be moving towards a bipartisan approach to reforming health care, not one party or the other party.
Marianne Udall-Phillips from the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation. Thanks so much for being with us.
Great to be here, Cindy. Thank you.
Up next, we learn about a program designed to bring more minority developers into Detroit's revitalization. That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Experimentation.
Curiosity.
The next idea.
Technology alone is not enough.
One of the central challenges in Detroit's revival is making sure that all boats rise, that good things are happening for longtime Detroiters, not just the newcomers and new businesses setting up in the city. Our latest contributor to The Next Idea is part of a program designed to bring more minority developers into Detroit's revitalization. Capital Impact Partners created its Equitable Development Initiative after it realized how little of its money was going to projects led by minority developers. Elizabeth Luther is the Senior Project Manager at Capital Impact Partners. Welcome to The Next Idea, Elizabeth.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Elizabeth, just how lopsided were things when it came to the money that Capital Impact Partners was loaning to developers in Detroit?
Capital Impact has been very active in Detroit over the past 10 years, and in particular the past 3 to 4 years. We've loaned over $175 million to projects in the city, largely in the Woodward corridor and in mixed-use corridors and neighborhoods around the city. When we looked at our balance sheet and the loans that we deployed in the city, while we were working with a number of development teams led by minorities, the amount we were loaning to those teams was smaller than it was to some of the other teams that we were working with. So about 10% of the capital that we were lending in the city was going to developers of color.
So you wanted to address that disparity and created the Equitable Development Initiative, which is what exactly? What do you do with it?
The Equitable Development Initiative is a new program that we've designed, and I want to give credit to a coworker of mine, a colleague, Melinda Clemens, who handles all of our business development in Detroit. This is really her brainchild, since she sees, you know, all of the borrowers that we work with on a day-to-day basis. All of those loans go through her first. So we came up with the idea of supporting developers with a kind of wraparound suite of services. So mentorship from other more experienced developers, technical assistance in the form of financial consulting and legal consulting that are components of any real estate development deal at some point in the process, but with this program, they'll be provided earlier on, and they'll be supported through grant capital. And then the third component is that we are hoping to finance a few developers through this program that we might not otherwise be able to finance because of either a lack of access to capital. That's really one of the biggest barriers for less experienced or just less wealthy developers really to get into the game, or just lack of experience. So the idea is that the kind of three components of the program will address those two barriers to entry into the real estate development market.
You're launching, I know, next year with a cohort of 3 to 5 Detroit-based minority developers, and another cohort is planned in 2019. What do you think minority developers like these, who will be part of the Equitable Development Initiative, what do they bring to the revitalization of Detroit?
That's a great question. I think any real estate developer has their own perspective and, I guess, interest in what they'd like to do. What we're really trying to target in this program is local developers, people from the city who are interested in working in their neighborhoods or working in other areas around the city, but kind of have more contextual experience in the places that they're working.
If other capital firms wanted to launch an initiative like this one in their cities, what advice would you offer to help them succeed? And I know you've yet to really, you know, get this going with the first cohort of developers, but as you've been doing the groundwork, what have you learned?
What I've seen is there, you know, there are some models around the country of programs like this. They all seem to be very different, and they're very contextualized to the local market and the local needs. So I think a first step would be to really understand where the gaps are locally. Capital Impact is a nonprofit lender. We're a community development financial institution, and there are certain areas where we're comfortable lending as well. So a second step would be matching the organization's capabilities and really appetite for exploring a new type of lending or fitting in a new program with the type of lending that the organization is already comfortable with, and then matching that with the needs of a place. In programs like this, there are really two components or two main components. One is training or mentorship and really just sharing the knowledge of how real estate development really works in a place. And there are so many different components of that, construction management and really understanding permitting and code enforcement in a particular city or municipality. Then there's the financing side of things. And there aren't many programs that really pair the two together. I think there's a lot of really excellent training programs out there with the goal of shepherding participants in the program toward being more financeable or getting financing for a specific project. So really thinking through all of the steps that it would take to get to the financing component, something worth thinking through very early on as well.
Are you still accepting applications from developers?
We are. So applications are open through November 30th, so they're open for the next month on our website.
And we have put a link to the Equitable Development Initiative from Capital Impact Partners on the Next Idea page at michiganradio.org. If you and I were talking in, say, 3 or 4 years, Elizabeth Luther, what are you hoping we would be able to say about what the Equitable Development Initiative has been able to do?
That there are more developers of color participating in real estate development in Detroit, just across the board. Part of the goal of the program is to see just a broader kind of professional development, cohort development, system of support in place for developers locally. So part of the goal is to really retain more developers in the city. You know, in some cases, Detroit has had to deal with brain drain, where talented individuals end up leaving the city for better opportunities elsewhere. We're really hoping to contribute to building a system of support for local minority developers in order to retain that talent and contribute to the cycle of giving back to Detroit neighborhoods locally over the coming years.
Elizabeth Luther is Senior Project Manager at Capital Impact Partners. It's Equitable Development Initiative, empowering minority developers in Detroit. Elizabeth, thanks for being with us on The Next Idea.
Great. Thanks for having me, Sydney.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
What happens to a school's biggest so-called troublemakers when they get lengthy suspensions or they're kicked out altogether? Where can they go? One place is Lighthouse Academy in Kent County. Its mission statement, creating hope through academic success in spite of life's storms. Lighthouse Academy is one of 9 Michigan charter schools that are known as Strict Discipline Academies, or SDAs, designed to help rehabilitate students who are getting in trouble, kids struggling in the traditional school setting. Lighthouse Academy Superintendent Heidi Kate is here with us now. Good to have you here on the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
What is exactly a strict disciplinary academy?
Well, it was established in the mid-1980s after the Columbine incident in Colorado. At that time, there was an effort across the United States to address how to keep students safe and kind of an anti-violence effort. And so the zero tolerance law was put into place. And Michigan interpreted that law pretty strictly, established its own code, and that established strict discipline academies, which stated that students who were expelled from school or long-term suspended, or what's called IEP placed, which is special education needs students that need more small, kind of tightly controlled environments, could apply to and enroll in a strict discipline academy, whereas particularly if they were expelled for certain categories of behavior, such as weapons possession in school, assault of staff, bomb or arson within a school, or a sex offense on grounds in a school, that there would be zero tolerance and they would be expelled for a mandatory of 180 days and sometimes permanently from public schools. And strict discipline academies were established and particularly were given the okay to service those students during the period of their expulsion and sometimes until they graduate, which is what we do at Lighthouse Academy.
What do you offer at Lighthouse that a student won't get at a traditional school? I guess I'm asking, what does strict discipline look like at your school?
You know, and it's interesting because Strict Discipline Academy was coined by Representative Hart at the time in the mid-1980s. And what he had thought was that, and there was very much a trend in the juvenile kind of justice realm for boot camps. So at that point, they were, you know, saying that terminology, okay, let's be very strict, kind of a behavior modification approach, very boot camp-like. But I'll be honest with you, that's not what we find is successful with these students. What we find is we do a lot of therapeutic services and life skills and job skill programming, along with the academic education to give them a diploma that they earn. We're a very whole child focused program. We are not a boot camp. We are not, you know, it wouldn't look like the kids are in like the detention center unless they are and we are educating there. But our program folds in therapeutic services, job skill, life skill programming, because those are the things that the students are struggling with that get in the way of them accessing the content in order to get their credits and their diploma.
I suspect for so many of these young people, they don't see the point.
Absolutely. I think that that is very true. And I think that, you know, what we find in our programs is that ultimately the kids don't begin to be interested in the educational component for sure, but even our other services to help them with the things that they're struggling with, whether it's the mental health counseling or substance abuse counseling or life skill or job skills, even if they're interested in getting a job, what you have to do first is you have to really break through and establish a relationship with them first. And what we find is that these kids really, once they know that we are going to, and the term we use is stick to them like glue, and a very tough glue, is that we don't give up on them. We continue to develop that relationship, and then they then open the doors. They begin to trust us. And once that's established, we're very, you know, proud to say that we just surpassed our 200th graduate with a full high school diploma, and many of our kids go on to post-secondary education. What I think works for them is we deliberately stay at low ratio, so the kids are very, very well known. So we have very small sites. Our largest one is not quite 100 students. And our adult-to-student ratio with different roles and responsibilities besides teaching is about a 1-adult-to-9-kid ratio. So these kids are very intimately and well-known, and we become like a secondary family for them.
What grades are we talking about?
Well, you know, and I'm going to probably say something that's a little shocking, and we are K through 12. Now, most of our students that come to us in our community campuses are middle schoolers and high schoolers, but because of the fact that strict discipline academies can also serve kids who are court referred or court affiliated, who are on probation or involved with the Department of Health and Human Services, we are at residential treatment centers as well. And those kids, because of the fact that CPS will put kids in shelter care, we do sadly go down to sometimes having kindergartners. So we do have elementary age students in our classrooms.
I'm speaking with Heidi Kate. She is superintendent of Lighthouse Academy, based in Kent County, one of Michigan's SDAs, Strict Disciplinary Academy. And you are hoping to see a change in state law concerning kids who are on long-term suspension. What kind of change and why?
That's correct. The initial Strict Discipline Academy language that was put together in the 1980s still stays as it was, and we're asking for a change, which says that kids who are long-term suspended are eligible and may enroll in a strict discipline academy, but the language that we want stricken out is the student must return to their school district that they were suspended from after their suspension ends. And the reason why we would like that to be changed is not all students, not only are they not ready sometimes for that, they're still working on their issues. Sometimes it's not advisable for their safety or the safety of the students of the school that they came from, due to sometimes it involves other students there that would be better to kind of break ties and kind of have a new, turn over a new leaf for both the student and the students back in the old school district. It is really important to us that when the student begins to feel some success, it is not unusual for them, their families, and or their referring probation officer or case manager to really say, you know, we would like the student to stay beyond the suspension because they begin to have some success and they don't want them to kind of revert back to the old ways kind of thing. So we just want to have that choice for the benefit and in the best interest of the student that they be able to stay. The expelled students are able to stay as long as their enrollment is continuous past the period of their expulsion, but the long-term suspended, for whatever reason, was not written into the law to be able to stay if that was in their best interest or if they chose to.
Heidi, in order to give us an idea of what would be lost if Lighthouse Academy and the other SDAs weren't around, give us a story of a student whose life path was truly changed by coming to Lighthouse Academy. You don't have to mention a name, but give us an idea of the situation a youngster was in.
Well, the first student that comes to mind is one of the very first students when we opened before we became a strict discipline academy in the 2008-09 school year. We were actually a pilot program totally privately funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Alternative High School Initiative. And we began in 2005 with our first group of students, around 15 to 17 students. And there was one female that was from one of the large school districts here in Kent County who came, and the referring person, who was the discipline officer, literally, this is a quote, said to me, "Well, good luck with this one. I know if you're successful with her, perhaps this program will work and I'll refer others to you." So, and what he was referring to is she was a ninth grader and she had a long history of multiple suspensions, which dated all the way back, believe it or not, to her upper elementary years. Quite a long history of behavior issues, fighting with other students, lots of turmoil in the home, a lot of transiency due to financial issues with the family, jumping between different school districts within the county. So a lot of instability for the whole family, including this student. And the student was, we literally thought that she might be mute because she did not speak for weeks when she first came to us. And that high level of distrust that she had with adults, we learned later there's some patterns of trauma and some abuse that she unfortunately has sustained from some other adults outside of the family when she was young. it took us a long time to develop trust with her. And by slowly kind of developing a relationship, looking at how we could get her to say a few words here or there, then it grew to sentences and paragraphs. And then we got her into some treatment to try to work through the old trauma of some of the abuse that she had sustained, got her mom involved. Mom was a wonderful woman. She really, I think, had a lot of fear about being kind of labeled as a bad parent. But really, through the work with her daughter, she began to open up with us and got involved in a very, very deep way with her daughter's education, started seeing her daughter opening up, was very grateful. Her own tough exterior kind of cracked. And
where is she today? Where is this young woman today?
Oh, she's wonderful. So she has children of her own. She is finishing college. She has a job, full-time job, and I run into her at stores throughout Kent County. She always gives me a hug and gives me an update on her kids and how proud she is of them and how well they're doing in school. And to me, it's turning around that cycle so that we don't not only not feed the school-to-prison pipeline, which these kids, I think, are at the greatest risk, but hopefully we break that generational cycle so that we have successful students and adults for the future in our community.
Heidi Kate is the superintendent of Lighthouse Academy in Kent County, one of nine Michigan charter schools that are strict discipline academies, SDAs, as she says, breaking that pipeline into prisons that we so often see these troubled young students following. Heidi, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Still to come, the new study looks at what happens when hateful online hangouts are banned. Plus, the latest in Michigan sports. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Online trolls, the mere thought of them can get your blood pressure rising. Social media outlets have wrestled with how to strike a balance between allowing free speech, yet not letting trolls and haters wreak their havoc. Just banning a troll doesn't make much of a difference. It's so easy to change up your screen name and jump right back out there lobbing hate-filled posts. So what if the focus shifted from cracking down on the trolls to taking away their online hangouts? A recent study by researchers at Emory University, Georgia Institute of Technology, and the University of Michigan explored that very question. Eric Gilbert is one of those researchers. He's an associate professor with the School of Information at U of M. Eric, this study focused on Reddit. Just what were you looking at?
Well, in 2015, Reddit banned a number of hate communities that had been on the site for a long time. Two of the communities were pretty well known at the time. One was called Fat People Hate, and the other was called Coontown.
Okay, well, I guess we can take away immediately going on there.
That's right. I think they're pretty self-evident.
Yes.
And so what they did is that just one day they turned them off. They used to be there, and now they're not. What we studied was, what was the impact of that intervention? Did it actually work? It's hard to empirically study stuff like this because it doesn't happen very often.
I can imagine. So how did you go about this? Before you tell us what you found, what did it take to come to do your research?
Well, the first thing we needed was all the data, right? So luckily, there are folks within Reddit who make a lot of data available, and then there are folks on the internet who package up that data. So we were able to use a large data set of every post and every comment that was made on Reddit in 2015. So that's about 500 million posts.
So you could do the while these two forums were in business and once they vanished.
Yep.
What'd you find?
So we found that, at least in the way we defined it working, it worked. The ban worked. We defined working, whether it would work, in two ways. One was how it affected the people that were involved in these spaces, that were talking all the time in these spaces. And then two, how I was more interested in the second question, was how it affected the communities. So there's been this longstanding idea in internet communities that if you stamp out a bad behavior, it's just going to spread all over the place. One argument for letting it sit there and do what it's doing is that if you try to take it away, it'll spread to more mainstream locations. And we wanted to test whether that was true.
And what'd you find?
We found that, one, on the first question, that individuals went away at a higher frequency than expected. They stopped using the hate speech they were using before. And in the second case, there was no discernible effect on nearby communities. And I'm air quoting nearby because that's kind of a complicated operation, you know,
but
way to operationalize
it. Wasn't like you saw a trend where they just scattered elsewhere and were kind of spewing the same things.
They did go other places.
Okay.
Right. So they did go to other places. They went to, if you're familiar with Reddit, there was a big migration to the Donald, which is the subreddit devoted to Donald Trump. We did not see the same language that they were using in the hate communities replicated again in these new spaces.
What does that tell us? Was it the chemistry of these folks hanging out in these two? I mean, was there?
That's a good question. That's a really good question. The best answer I can give, the most honest answer I can give, is we don't know why it worked. We don't know exactly the mechanism that made it work. We have some hunches about why it would have worked.
Such as?
So one of them is what you just said, right? Which is that there are social norms that are in place in these communities that tamp down bad behavior. We've talked to moderators, a few just like informally and anecdotally. We've talked with people who moderate some of the communities that received some of these migrants. And I think one of the takeaways was, we stomped that out pretty fast. And there were multiple reasons. They, at least some of these moderators we talked to, they reported they didn't want to be the next ones. They didn't want their community to be the next thing that Reddit's hammer nailed down.
Yeah, so tone it down, people.
Tone it down, people. Reddit's on the hunt, right? And we know that there was some conversation around that time. It could be a lot of things. Another good example is we know a lot of these people just left Reddit. They went to a different online community that's more permissive, where they could say what they wanted to go to.
And what would be an example? I mean, I'm certainly, I mean, were they going to Twitter and Facebook, or were they going deeper into
The conventional wisdom is that they were going to a site called Vote, V-O-A-T. I recommend you do not go there.
Thank you. Forewarned is forearmed.
Yeah.
So that's an ecosystem friendly to trolls and haters?
It has very, very permissive moderation schemes, right? So I'm not going to say everything there is bad, but I do say that one of the main claims they make that the reason they exist is because Reddit banned these spaces.
So I'm wondering what precedents this tactic sets in terms of limiting free speech. I mean, thinking of a forum focused on hating people because of their weight or their skin color is pretty low-hanging fruit. But we've seen some social media and online platforms doing some banning that's raised questions of free speech. YouTube taking heat earlier this year when its restricted mode started blocking LGBTQ content, even the family-friendly stuff. Last year, Twitter suspended some major alt-right accounts, and there was big pushback. So where do we go with this? What's the boundary line?
It's really, really hard to say. One thing I will point out is that it's tricky on so many levels. We say free speech, but whose free speech are we talking about here? One of the things we have to point out is that all this stuff is transnational. So it's not even clear whose laws apply. And even among Western countries, there's considerable variation in how free speech is interpreted. Canada's different from Germany, is different from the United States. So that's like one pretty complicated sticking point. The other thing that gets lost sometimes in this freedom of speech conversation is the fact that there are companies involved. These are companies. Reddit does not have to uphold the First Amendment. It is not a public space. It is a privately owned space. Now, we could have a very long and, I think, thoughtful conversation about whether that's the right way for it to be.
But
right?
It is the way it
is. It is the way it is. It is the way it is. I'm not sure it's the best idea to cede the regulation and enforcement of free speech to private firms. And that's currently what we have. They're not set up for this. They're not set up for this.
This tactic that Reddit used, when it just basically took the candy store where the bad kids were hanging out, and it's gone. There's no more candy store to hang out. So these two forums are deleted. Could that tactic be applied to other social media platforms outside of Reddit?
So many of things in these kinds of empirical studies are really dependent on the context and the particular implementation. So, for example, it's not clear if you wanted to directly port the results of this research to Twitter, how would you do it? There isn't a group. There isn't a congregation area that everybody goes to.
Hashtags.
Hashtags is probably the closest analog, and it's not great. I mean, on Facebook, you could argue that Facebook groups serve a similar purpose, but I don't think they are the same in, you know, a number of other ways. They're not discoverable, for example, in the same way that subreddits are. And I think all these things are subtle. They all matter. And it's really hard to tease it apart. So I'm relatively cautious when I say, you know, and I have been approached by people from other platforms, and I'm saying, you know, I'm pumped the brakes a little bit, right? All the details matter.
So what questions do you have now based on what you found out in this study? Where do you want to go with this?
I mean, banning is one. We actually have a long research arc that's somewhere in the middle about moderation practices on online communities. So one thread we're looking at is how do you make moderators' lives easier by building machine learning prediction models about what is likely to be taken off site eventually. Kind of more in line with this stuff, we are probably going to look at the kinds of feedback that quote-unquote bad actors or bad users receive that limits their bad behavior. So let's say we have all of Reddit. We have all of this, and I hope nobody steals my study idea here. All right, I'm going to paint the study idea. The idea is, you know, take all of Reddit and then look at all of the types of feedback that they could possibly receive, like somebody calling them out in the comments, somebody downvoting them, somebody questioning their motives, somebody telling them to go away. And are any of these kind of naturally occurring behaviors actually effective in limiting subsequent future troll behavior?
Troll behavior.
Yeah.
Do you see any true way to keep the troll behavior, the hate and the haters off the internet? Or is it going to be incumbent on users of the internet and social media platforms to police themselves and not go to sites where you're going to see this kind of stuff?
I mean, here's where my American culture values are going to show here, right? I'm not even sure that would be desirable. I'm not sure that stamping out all the deviant behavior from all of the internet, would even want that. Like, would we want an internet that looked that way? Mm-hmm. I would say no. I mean, I don't think so. I think there's lots of great kinds of deviant behavior that I'm glad exists.
Well, and right, as you say, where's the boundary line?
Who gets to define the
boundary line?
Who gets
to define it?
You're seeing other countries take a very, like, we've been watching what's happening in Germany lately. They've instituted a new law saying that if social media companies leave hate speech on for a certain amount of time, they're going to be fined. So that's a very top-down approach. I mean, you're seeing a lot of variation, actually, I think, in the ways that countries and societies are approaching this problem. But yeah, I would say I wouldn't want all the trolls deleted from the internet.
Eric Gilbert, associate professor with the School of Information at the University of Michigan. Interesting research, and thank you for sharing it with us.
Thanks.
Time to talk sports with Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. And let's start on a couple happy notes. Justin Verlander starts in a huge game, Game 6 of the World Series tomorrow night, which could be the game that wins Houston its first championship. Great guy. What a great game that was last night.
Another great game. This is being called potentially one of the all-time great World Series. Now, for that to happen, I hate to tell you, Verlander has to lose, and it's got to go Game 7.
Yeah.
You're never a classic World Series if it goes to Game 6. But he's been pitching extraordinarily well, even better than his Detroit days the last couple of years. And you know doggone well, no matter how much money you got, if you are a professional athlete, you want that ring, and he is that close, and it's now in his hands, which for a pitcher,
wow,
it's only one out of four shots.
Well, so great guy. Yay for JV. And the Pistons knocked off defending champs Golden State 115-107. Surprising and sweet win?
Yeah, very surprising in some ways, and definitely a sweet win. It's regular season, I grant you. But I've always believed, and we've talked about it, Stan Van Gundy is a heck of a coach, and they're going the right direction.
Now, let's go to the sour notes. This is turning into...
So that was the good news, everybody.
Yeah, we're done with that. We're going to talk about the fall of discontent for Lions fans. It was starting as a promising season, turning sour, and that loss last night to the Steelers, third straight loss. What is up with a team that gets itself in the red zone five times last night and couldn't score a touchdown?
A bit surprising, actually, because Stafford is a hell of a quarterback.
Yeah.
You've got Golden Tate back. That's your go-to guy. And not one touchdown, five field goals. And Prater has got to be one of the best field goal kickers in the league. We've already established that. But I'm also surprised, too, because Pittsburgh does very poorly on the road, as does Roethlisberger. But he nails a 97-yard the whole way,
yes,
basically, his touchdown pass. So you play it against a championship team, basically.
How much of the sputtering season is on Jim Caldwell?
Tough call, because more so in the NFL than in college, it's a CEO program that he's in charge of the whole thing, but he does not make the calls on offense or defense. You can supersede, but those guys are pretty much autonomous. The players like the guy. I know that. The family loves the guy. He's very good with quarterbacks is what their reputation is. I see him as a glorified Brady Hoke, though. You see him during the game, and he's a deer in headlights. I don't see him making decisive decisions. His game management, which means the time element and so on, what to call when with the clock and whatnot, is not very good, and that was on display last night, sad to say, when they're down only 20-15, and your husband, I believe, was yelling at him.
Screaming at them. There was a lot of screaming last night, I will just say that, particularly when they went for a touchdown instead of the field goal that could have made all the difference and won them the game.
Exactly right. Two field goals, guess what, 6 points, and you win. Mm-hmm. My basic take on this team is they're not going to be in the cellar with Stafford in this roster, and Bob Quinn, the new GM, is very bright from New England. But they're not going to win a Super Bowl title either. They're built to be a wild card team, and that's what they're going
to
be.
Over to the Spartans over the weekend. Tough loss in the third overtime period against Northwestern. What went wrong, and how did Lewerke do as a quarterback?
I would say two things. One, Northwestern is notorious under Pat Fitzgerald of losing some games in September they shouldn't lose, and they did. Then they start picking teams off they shouldn't beat in October, and they did that too. So they're not a team you want to play this time of year. So they played a very good game, in fairness to the Spartans. The flip side is Brian Lewerke is their second leading rusher as a quarterback. He's not fast. He's just really smart and courageous and reads the play very well. He's got 14 touchdowns against only 4 interceptions. That's a very good ratio right there. However, in overtime, triple overtime in this case, he fumbles the snap. He goes around chasing it in the backfield. And instead of just throwing the ball away and eating it, he throws the ball into triple coverage down in the end zone. He panicked, basically, and paid for it, and the game is lost. That said, they are 6-2, the Spartans. You ask any Spartan fan in August about 6-2, they would have taken that readily, especially with a win yet again over Michigan.
There you go. Over to the Wolverines with a comfortable win over Rutgers and a big quarterback change. What do you think of redshirt freshman Brendan Peters out there replacing John O'Korn?
I think that's your new quarterback at Michigan. And Harbaugh essentially said that in the post-game press conference, which they never do. They always say, well, look at the film and see practice and compete. No, he said that's our guy, pretty much. So that is your guy going forward if you're a Michigan fan. He played extremely well. Now people all say, yeah, it's Rutgers. It was also Rutgers the first quarter and a half when on 4 possessions they could get 1 touchdown. He had 1 pick already, O'Korn did, and not going anywhere. So that was the same team, and Peters seems to be the future. He's also, as you said, a redshirt freshman, so he's got time to break in.
And people need to be patient. This is not the second coming, right?
To be patient. Yeah, good luck with that one right there. Yeah, yes, because they're known for that, the patience.
Yes, they are. All right, we need to turn to a story that, if true, is awfully disturbing. Michigan quarterback Wilton Spate fractured 3 vertebrae during that game against Purdue on September 23rd, and now his father, Bobby, is talking openly about how Purdue handled his son's injury.
Read the article by Angelique Shingalis at the Detroit News, which came out on Friday, I believe, on Purdue and medical care. When you first see the hit, look, it was after the play. It was could have been whistled for that. It was also targeting head-to-head. But you thought, okay, he strained his neck. 3 cracked vertebrae, which no one knew at the time, obviously. No one even guessed this. Because he got up okay and walked off.
Took a little while, though.
It took a little while, but there he was. I cannot do it justice. Read the article, but basically horrible medical care from that point on. No x-ray machine anywhere near the locker.
They took him to the student health center?
And they were without a police escort, so you're waiting 45 minutes. This guy is sitting in a car in a traffic accident with 3 cracked vertebrae. If they get into a fender bender, he might be in serious trouble. So this thing could have gone really, really badly. As it was, it's pretty bad. Harbaugh, to his credit, in my opinion, spoke about this at the Monday press conference, saying we need higher standards in the Big Ten across the board. Didn't pick on Purdue as such, but pointed that out. And look, if you're Wilton Spate's dad said it, and it hit home with me, if I am now looking at a college for my son's future, I am now asking them about medical care. I'm asking them about what kind of facilities they've got in the locker room and elsewhere, because if this happens, I want to know he's getting the best possible care. And at Michigan you do, and at Michigan State you do, and Purdue get in line and student health behind a kid with a cold.
And
it's crazy.
And get asked for your insurance card.
Insurance card. He's currently in a football uniform. Where exactly do you store your insurance card?
What struck me, too, is once they asked for an ambulance, and this is, again, all spelled out in the Detroit News story, it took about a half an hour for this volunteer rescue team to take him to a hospital, and they didn't want to turn on lights and siren. And he was starting to have tingling in his legs. He's in pain. And thank God for the U of M sports medicine fellow who was there,
right,
who just blew a gasket at them.
He did, and the driver said, "Don't get smart with me," as a direct quote. It was like, wait a second, that's not... My job is to look out for this kid.
Wow.
I've been on the sidelines. I have to say that stress this after the famous Shane Morris game and so on. I've been on the sidelines with those guys for 3 seasons, 08, 09, 2010. Dr. Bruce Miller, Dr. Carpenter, the training staff, who's first, Len and Phil and so on, first rate, Paul Schmidt. I have never seen them ever have a conversation with a coach about a player. It is one directional communication. When Tate Forcier, when Denard's got a concussion, he is out of the game, and we're telling you that he's out of the game. We're not discussing how bad it is or if he might get in. That is how it happens at Michigan, and I believe at Michigan State as well. What's happening at Purdue is unconscionable and will get changed.
What do we know about how Wilton Spate's doing now, recovering from these 3 cracked vertebrae?
Yeah, no kidding. Amazingly, he might be back this season is what they're saying. It's possible.
Okay.
I'm sure we could check out the five ways to Sunday. Yeah. So now you're on your third quarterback at Michigan, of course. So we'll see how Brendan Peters does. You're not playing for probably a Big Ten title, definitely not a national title. So there's not any kind of urgency that way. But he might be back. And if he is back, we'll see what happens there. But the main thing is get the kid healthy. I've seen Wilton Spate study in the basement of a store on Main Street every Sunday, by the way. He's got a serious student, a fine young man, and you hope he does very well.
Michigan Radio sports commentator John Eubank. And as always, thanks, John.
Thank you, Cindy.
You can join me and the entire Stateside team this coming Thursday. We're doing a live show in East Lansing. We'll have a conversation with longtime Lansing Mayor Virge Bonero, feature a Lansing area artisan, and learn why the Mid-Michigan region is a landing spot for refugees from all over the world. Catch that and more by joining us this Thursday, November 2nd at the Kellogg Center at the MSU campus starting at 7. Details at michiganradio.org. And that's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.